It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Rob Ferret is out today. You are with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, 2015 was a big year for science news. We'll talk to an editor at Discover Magazine about the top stories in neuroscience, math, and physics. First, a shooting at the mall in Madison caused panic this weekend, and schools in several states have shut down because of threats in the past week. While the events themselves are different, they both involve responding to stressful and possibly dangerous situations quickly. Back in October, we had UW-Madison's chief of police on the show to talk about how people can stay safe during mass shootings. And we wanted to have her on again to talk about these events more recently and how police and bystanders should respond. Joining us now is Susan Reisling, chief of police at the UW-Madison Police Department. Chief Reisling, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when your department gets a call for an incident that might be similar to the shooting at Easttown Mall in Madison this past weekend, how do you respond?
Quickly. The key really is speed, getting there, getting as much information as you can possibly gather from the callers that are calling. And of course, when you have a situation like a mall shooting, you're going to get multiple callers. And depending on what they saw, you're going to get multiple incidents, given to you, even though maybe it's one incident, people just see it 10 different ways. So those are always challenging, but you have to get there. You have to get there quick, and then you've got to sort out exactly what's going on and what people saw versus what actually happened.
And then you've got, in this case, a mall during the holidays filled with people, teeming with people, children, families,
yes,
older people. So how does that factor into how police respond?
Well, the thing about the mall shooting that we have to keep in mind, because I know a lot of people have said, it's a gun-free zone and that's why it happened there. And, that's just not the truth. What happened was it's a long-standing feud between people and they decided to work it out there. So what happens in those situations is obviously if you hear gunfire anywhere, whether you're in a mall, a theater, wherever you are these days, church, you need to try as fast as you can to get away from it and to try to get out. And if you can not get out, then you've got to try to hide and as quickly as possible get to 911 and tell the police what it is that you know and what it is that you actually saw so that they can begin to put together a coordinated response.
Well, what you described, getting away from it, getting safe as quickly as possible, in a way that did seem to happen at this Easttown Mall incident. On the other hand, there was panic. Panic is a word, a reasonable response, of course, to what happened. But there were children separated from their families. There were people, by some accounts, sort of stampeding. Was that what you would expect to happen as people try to get safe, or could people have done anything differently?
Oh, I think that is one of the things that you can expect to have happen. It's unfortunate. You wish everybody could just, remain calm. But the fact of the matter is that it's human nature to fight or flight. And in this situation, during flight, people do get separated from their loved ones and their kids and all of those things. And today, we've got the ability to get back in touch with each other relatively quickly through text messaging and so forth in ways that we didn't, in the past. But yeah, I think any time you bring a gun into a crowded place, you can expect panic if one is used.
We're speaking right now with UW-Madison's Chief of Police, Susan Reisling, talking about how the public and police respond to shooting incidents and threats of violence. There was a shooting over the weekend at Easttown Mall in Madison, also looking at a couple of closed schools across the country because of threats of violence. And Chief Reisling, I want to pick up on something you said, that some people had been saying that the reason that the shooting happened at the mall was because this was a gun-free zone. And this morning we had news that State Representative Bob Gannon released a statement saying that it's time to end gun-free zones like the one at Easttown. What do you think of his statement and the fact he's obviously asserting here that if people had guns, civilians might have been armed, maybe this wouldn't have happened?
Oh, yeah, we can only imagine. Let's just think about that. Okay, so two people have a dispute in the mall. 15 people start to argue and fight, and they're fighting. And in the middle of the argument between all of these people that was going on at Easttown Mall, somebody pulls out a gun and shoots the gun off. Now you got a crowded mall with all these shoppers, and now you instead have two dozen people with guns all of a sudden, all carrying concealed. They're all the good guy with a gun. They're going to stop the bad guy with a gun. I just can't even fathom how bad that could have gotten, how quickly. Because people who don't know who shot the first shot see somebody else with a gun, and they don't know what's going on. And it's just more chaos on top of more chaos. And I really think that the representative doesn't understand the nature of the crime at Easttown, which was two people who knew one each other who had a dispute, and all of the concealed carry in the world is not going to stop that kind of situation from playing out. That shooting at Easttown could have just as easily happened in the neighborhood where the two people are from, or it could have just happened randomly on the street corner. That's not something that concealed carry is going to stop in any way. And a matter of fact, I just think it's going to make things far worse if we don't do something to get background checks completely covered, and also make sure that only responsible law-abiding citizens are the ones with the weapons. We need to stop the illegal gun flow, and we need to do a number of things, but giving more people weapons at Easttown Mall is definitely not the answer.
We're going to switch gears now and look at schools in California and New Hampshire that had closed down recently because of threats of violence. Is this a new frontiers for schools, or are most schools ready to go in what's been a post-Columbine world for a long time now?
No, I think it's a new frontier. I think we as a country have some really tough decisions to make. Here's the dilemma I think school administrators face. First, the threat comes in, and whether it is credible or not is not always easy to ascertain. But even if you ascertain that the threat is not particularly credible, it's a lot of weight to put on a school administrator's shoulders to decide to keep the classrooms open and functioning on the very off chance, the very unlikely chance, that the threat is actually a credible threat and is actually going to be put into motion. And so, out of an abundance of caution, many school administrators will close their elementary school, middle school, high school, etc. And that's a real problem, because the more that we close because someone makes a threat, the more power we're shifting into people's hands who don't want to take exams, who don't like what's going on in the school for whatever reason, or as we saw recently with the University of Chicago, people who have nothing to do with the University of Chicago, get wrapped up in this dilemma. They actually were able to arrest the individual in the Chicago situation, but in the Los Angeles or the New Hampshire situation, those threats came actually from overseas. And, you know, it's just very, very difficult. I think there's a certain element in our society that somehow thinks this is funny to be able to have that kind of power to close down a school system. And so those folks in school systems have to be really careful to balance and weigh whether the threat is credible or not. The public will be completely unforgiving if a threat is called in, a school district doesn't close, and the threat is acted upon. Yet at the same time, we all know that we're going to get threat fatigue. And the more and more we shut down these places, and the more and more we try to sort out what's going on, the more the paradigm shifts over to those that want to just wreak havoc and cause chaos and really do affect major institutions.
And given all that, what do you want school administrators to know about the world that we live in and how they need to start framing these events as they go forward and this may become more common?
Well, I think that really we need a very strong working relationship between law enforcement and the school districts to really credibly go through the threat. We also need the help, quite frankly, because a lot of this covers, you know, state lines or country to country. We need the federal government to step up here and be a part of this and to really be able to assess these threats as credible or not. And then to be able to share with people the fact that a threat has been made, but that it is deemed not credible. And then parents need to make a decision about whether they want to send their child to school that day. But to close the whole institution is really shifting the power differential from our institutions to lone wolves who are really just out to cause chaos and havoc.
How much have things changed when we talk about the possibility of threats against public institutions or mass shootings? How much has this changed during your tenure in law enforcement?
Oh, it's changed tremendously, but it's ebbed and flowed. In the Vietnam era, which was before my time in the profession, we did have bombings right here at the University of Wisconsin in Sterling Hall and the Red Gym. We did have those things happen, and so that's a part of American history. Then we saw it wane through the 80s and 90s and picked up again in the 90s with the World Trade Center and also, obviously, Oklahoma City, and it shifted into a different psychology. In the late 90s is when we began to see the Lone Wolf Act, the Columbines, and then in the 2000s, obviously, Virginia Tech, NIU, and so on. And we all know the long, long litany between Newtown and Aurora, Colorado, and all of the different mass casualty shootings. We have reached a tipping point where disgruntled people think it is within the playbook to take a gun and to just take out whatever their grievance is on people who have little or nothing to do with what the situation is that came upon the grievance in the first place. And we as a country are going to have to figure out a way to deal with this, because the proliferation of weapons and the proliferation of people who believe that this is an okay thing to do has really spiraled.
Chief Reisling, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and I only wish we had a happier topic before the holidays. Happy holidays to everyone.
And the same to you. That was UW-Madison's Chief of Police, Susan Reisling, talking about how the public should respond to shooting incidents and threats of violence and what the new climate is like going forward. Every Monday in December, we're taking a look at the biggest stories in science from 2015 with editors at Discover Magazine. And today we're looking at the standout stories in neuroscience, math, and physics. From new brain scan techniques to a crisis in confidence in the psychology world, 2015 was a big year. Bill Andrews is joining us now. He's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Bill, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be back.
Well, so one of the biggest stories from 2015 led to a crisis of confidence in the psychology world, you say. What happened?
Well, it was kind of the culmination of a few other issues that have been affecting psychology. In recent years, there have been a few controversial studies that have come out, things that are showing scientifically accurately, according to the studies, things that couldn't possibly exist or failure to replicate classic experiments. And so psychologists have been worrying that there might be something amiss in their field, so they've been trying to get together a big comprehensive study trying to replicate a lot of the most of the high profile findings from 2008. Turned out to be the case. So when they were finally able to do that, a lot of different scientists, over 300 of them, tried to do these experiments again that had already been done. They found that the results were not really the same as they had been the first time, which in science, that's a big issue. That's the whole point of doing these studies scientifically, getting them published and peer-reviewed. They're supposed to be reproducible. And so when this big kind of meta-analysis trying to redo all these bigger experiments from the past came up with different results, it really sent a shockwave through the profession and made people think, maybe we should take a look at how we're doing things here.
Well, how has it changed things so far in psychology departments across the country?
I think it hasn't changed anything concretely in terms of new policies or new approaches, but it's gotten people to really start prioritizing the importance of replicating studies. And this is something that psychology is not the only instance of. A lot of the different sciences have had issues in the past where scientists replicating past studies is important, but it's not really given any support. You know, the sexiest findings are new things. Novelty comes out in front. And so it's almost it's easy to pay lip service to this idea of making sure that past studies are reproducible, but it isn't always come out on top. And so I think the first thing that's come out of this and that has been spreading this year is this kind of renewed sense of the importance of being able to replicate these studies.
And switching over to another story, this year researchers discovered a new technique for brain scans that could lead to better diagnoses. What's the story there?
Well, it's an issue that has come up a lot recently with all the veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. We've had, with over 1 million soldiers coming back, over 100,000 of them have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and another 300,000 have been told they have something different, a traumatic brain injury. And these are two different conditions that can affect someone, and they have very similar symptoms, insomnia, anxiety, and a lot of other things in common. So it had been very difficult to tell them apart, and there weren't any hard and fast medical scans or techniques that could easily tell you which one a patient had until this year. That was the big thing that came out, and it's a kind of a scan called SPECT scanning. It stands for Single Photon Emission Computed Tomography. And they've had that. That isn't a new type of scan, but this is a new application of it where they're able to take a look at someone's brain and see just from the way that the blood's flowing and the shape of the brain itself whether they have a traumatic brain injury or if they have post-traumatic stress or maybe both.
Well, given that this technology already existed, does that mean it's being put into use already pretty widely?
It has already started. It's been gaining a lot of traction. The study itself had... It showed 80 to 100% accuracy. So as soon as that came out, people started to take notice because that's really big numbers, especially for something like this where there hadn't been really any alternatives before.
We're talking with Discover Magazine's Bill Andrews, taking a look at some of the biggest science stories out of 2015 in the world of neuroscience, math, and physics. And we've got some cool math news, some geometry news. There is a new kind of pentagon, which I didn't know. You know, I've heard of discovering new species, new
right.
stars, not a new pentagon. What's this about?
Right, and it sounds kind of silly. It's like, oh, those mathematicians, they're not curing cancer, they're not discovering stars. What? They found a pentagon. You know, so what? But it's actually a more important finding than you might think. And so the thing itself is they have in math this problem called the tiling problem, which is just the idea of, can you take a shape and put it on a flat plane like a tabletop and with just that shape be able to fill up everything and extend it out to infinity? And so for a few shapes, that's very easy. Squares, you can imagine, they just stack up. Perfect. Triangles, also. And pentagons, a regular pentagon where all the sides are the same shape, that will not work. You just can't arrange them so that they fit that way. But if you kind of smush the pentagon a little bit and get it so that it has different different length sides, then you're able to get some of these almost magic pentagons that can tile the plane, as they say. And so in over 100 years or so, they've been able to find 14 types of pentagons that that were able to do this. But for the last 30 years, they couldn't find any more. The last one was found in 1985. But then... And now here's where I have to again remind people this matters. This year is the one they found the new kind of pentagon that can tile the plane. And it's exciting not just for mathematicians who are able to work out all kinds of new problems and issues with this pentagon for them, but it's also important in the real world. I think every story I read about this had to say bathroom floor tile aficionados will be thrilled with the news. But it's also just a fundamentally important finding in the sense that this is a new shape with new properties that we didn't really know existed before. So now that we know how this shape, whether it is actual literal bathroom tiles or pieces of paper or arrangements of molecules, now that we know how they can come together, that can lead to things like new materials with novel properties, and it kind of opens up a whole new realm for what scientists are able to do.
Okay, you sold me. Pentagons matter. That's an interesting
Excellent.
One. And you've got this at number 55.
Yeah, we thought it would be a little bit of an in-joke to our pentagon enthusiasts that are right at number 55 there.
Oh, no coincidence there. Okay, So let's see. This year, the American Psychological Association voted to ban psychologists from participating in interrogations. Why did this one make your top 100?
Well, this one, it's less of a fun story than the Pentagon one, I guess. It's just this year was when the news came out officially that the American Psychological Association, the APA, had played a part in helping to legitimize the United States government's use of enhanced interrogation. This report called the Hoffman Report came out, and it said that members of the APA had been working with the Department of Defense, with the CIA, on different kinds of techniques, including waterboarding and beatings and sleep deprivation. And so it kind of lent it this veneer of respectability they're making sure it's still safe and effective, and so it should still be legal. And for almost a decade, the APA had been denying that. No, our people have not been involved in that. But when this report came out saying that actually they had been, the APA was very publicly chastened. You know, they were extremely they apologized for it and said it was extremely troubling and painful. And some of the higher ups have already lost their jobs, and it's possible they might even start to face criminal charges. So it was a big deal in getting this big organization to officially turn around on their involvement in this these behaviors.
And Bill, we've just got a couple of seconds left here, but leave us with a little bit about the Large Hadron Collider. Where are we there?
Well, everyone thinks its best days are behind her because it found the Higgs boson a few years ago, but actually that was just the start because now it can do anything. It's on the wild frontier after having found what they expected it to find. So whether it's new particles or new types of physics now, it's running at twice the power, so hopefully they'll be able to find some good new physics in the future.
So could show up on your list next year, or at least on the end of it.
That's right.
Well, Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. He joined us to go over the top stories in neuroscience, math, and physics from the year 2015. The holidays are usually billed as a time of year to be with family, for better or for worse. It can be a difficult season for people who grew up with strained or abusive relationships with their parents, and it's especially hard when those abusive parents are starting to get older and may need some help financially or otherwise. Emily Yaffe is with us now to talk about grown children dealing with abusive parents around the holidays. She's a contributing editor for The Atlantic and was the Dear Prudence Advice columnist for almost 10 years at Slate. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be here. Cheerful topic we have, right?
Well, that's why it's such a rough time of year, because you expect this to be a time of joyous togetherness with family, but it's not that way for a surprisingly large number of people, right?
Right. And as Dear Prudence, this time of year, I would always get a lot of letters from people really torn up about what to do. I mean, just in the larger issue that everyone is saying, oh, are you going to go home for the holidays? And then, you know, more specific, what do they do? Do they spend holidays with parents they'd rather not speak to? Do they try to put it behind them? It can be very difficult if you grew up with abusers.
And one thing that you point out, as you have over the years, is that the children of abusive parents, the adult children, they often feel isolated because they feel like everybody else is in these Brady Bunch families. But it turns out there are a lot of people who are going through this, but they just don't often talk about it.
I wrote a long story for Slate a couple of years ago now about what do adult children owe these now elderly abusive parents. And I literally, there were hundreds of comments from people saying, I thought I was the only one. I never talked to anyone about this. People would write to me personally, and I would have to say, you know, sadly, I'm sorry my story helped you, and you are really not alone.
We know that there are all kinds of different situations, and there are all kinds of different ways that the abuse can play out over the years. There can be physical abuse, there can be verbal abuse. But do the adult children have anything in common once they're grown?
Well, I looked at a lot of the studies, and obviously you don't need to look at a study to know that that kind of childhood can be absolutely devastating. And a lot of the people I spoke to had siblings who really were crushed. But what struck me was I was hearing from the people I think of as phoenixes. They rose from the most distressing circumstances, and over they said, you know, I've built a good career. I'm happily married. I have children. And now they're kind of grappling with these elderly parents and the needs they have. So, you know, we all can understand that people who grow up in abusive homes can repeat those patterns and have substance abuse problems themselves, or, you know, have broken relationships. But I was struck by the fact that childhood abuse does not write the whole script for your life, and how many people manage to overcome this.
Well, there is this, I guess you call it a trope or common wisdom in our society that it's good to heal the past, and you can heal the past by forgiving the person, often by reincorporating them into your life after maybe you've gotten some therapy and some perspective and you know how to set boundaries. But is that always the right answer?
In the years I did Prudence, I came to be kind of the anti-forgiveness person. Of course, I'm in favor of forgiveness, and forgiveness can be a wonderful thing. I think it's a two-way street. And what I often see is that the people who truly were victims of terrible situations are the ones who are put under pressure to forgive. Well, the forgiveness has to come from an acknowledgement and an asking for forgiveness by the wrongdoer. And that seems to be widely missing in our society. And I also, from hearing from so many people, people who tend to have been horrible parents tend not to be the people who can look at themselves and say, gee, I was a horrible parent, and I'm sorry you didn't have the kind of childhood you should have. So often these now adults who grew up in abusive circumstances are being pressured to forgive people who won't even acknowledge what they did.
So you're saying if someone hasn't asked for forgiveness, doesn't realize maybe even that they did anything wrong and scarred another person, then how do you forgive them?
Well, I don't think a lack of forgiveness means being psychologically stuck. I think the person who is abused can see the situation for what it was, accept that's what happened, say, I'm not going to be stuck there and relive this over and over. I'm going to move on and do something more with my life. But this did happen. I just don't think it's necessary for forgiveness to be part of the healing. Now, for a lot of people, it is. So what I feel is that people need to do what's best for them, for their healing, and for their mental health. So if people don't want to forgive, they shouldn't be pressured into it. If people feel, I feel stuck unless I do forgive, then find a way toward that.
We're talking with former Dear Prudence writer Emily Yaffe about how the grown children of abusive parents can manage the holidays. And so let's get to the holidays. Here's a season where it could be that someone is reaching out to you, a parent who's abused you in the past and wants to, you know, connect over the holidays. What do you suggest people do if this sort of thing happens and they've been abused and maybe they're not feeling terribly ready to do this thing?
I think this has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. A lot of people sort of set boundaries and limits. I will see this parent, you know, once a month under these set of circumstances. I will factor in the holidays. You know, I will only show up for X number of hours. If the parent starts drinking, I will leave. Okay, so those are people who've worked out boundaries. Some people don't have contact, and I don't, if that's what you need to do, I don't think you should break it for the holidays. So if there hasn't been contact and the pressure is coming to have a happy holiday, I think a holiday is not a good time for rapprochement. Much better to have some neutral day where you set a time limit to be together because the holidays are so terribly freighted.
And people, do you think people are stressed out over the holidays anyway? And then you add this this extra pressure, and it could be a recipe for things going even worse.
Right. You know, another aspect of this is grandchildren. I heard from a lot of people who, you know, said that their big issue was, what about their own children? Should their own children have a relationship with this abusive parent? And again, that has to be very case by case. If you had alcoholic, abusive parents and those parents are still alcoholic and abusive, you've got to protect your kids. I have heard from a number of people who said their parents, who were terrible to them, have turned out to be decent grandparents. So that's a complicated thing, and, you know, they want to have that, and I think that's wonderful, and it can be very healing for everyone. But again, the, you know, now adult person who was abused has to protect him or herself even while nurturing this next generation relationship.
Let's look beyond the holidays a bit, and you talked about this a bit already, but what if there's a grown child and they have a parent who they don't have a good relationship with? There was abuse in the past, but that parent now needs help. They may be financially unstable and need some money. They may need help with health care needs. How does that complicate the matter?
I answered one question about something along those lines, and it was a mother who was just, you know, physically, emotionally abusive in every possible way. And I gave a rather brutal answer, sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. You know, this sometimes is the price you pay for having been, not having done the things, just meet the minimum requirement of being a parent to your own children. So what is the child's obligation? Look, we have social services. You know, elderly people get Social Security. There's Medicare, Medicaid if needed. So I often say that people can be a go-between, so to make sure the parent is getting services and is not homeless. But at least this country does provide for the elderly. So that, you know, is not, doesn't have to be such a vivid concern. There are ways to get help secondhand for a parent you don't want to have any kind of relationship with.
We're talking with Emily Yaffe right now, former Dear Prudence writer, talking about how the grown children of abusive parents can manage the holidays and beyond that. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you the child of abusive parents? How do you manage that relationship with them, especially over the holidays? And what advice do you have for others who might be in a similar situation? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're picking up our discussion now about the grown children of abusive parents at the holidays. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you have a troubled relationship with your parents? And how do you manage that relationship over the holidays? And what advice do you have for other people? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. Matt is first in Pleasant Prairie. Matt, hi.
Matt from Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. You hear me all right?
Yep. A little distorted on the phone, but I think we got you.
Great. I just wanted to say, listening to this kind of touches the nerve a little bit, because when I was 7, my father died. I was a freak accident, and there were 6 kids in my family. My mother was kind of thrown into chaos by the whole death of my father, who's a great and loving father. She remarried shortly afterwards, about a year later, after he died. And a number of young children in our family, of course. And he was an abusive alcoholic. And I don't think my mother had the tools, having never dealt with somebody like this, to be able to deal with somebody who was like him. She'd never met anybody like him. You know, her parents were good, loving people. And this guy was a monster in many ways. He was just, you know, constantly berating us and beating us down. And so anyhow, at one point my mother went to had an intervention, and we, some of the children at least, went to Hazleton up in Minnesota, and where he had gone to get treatment. And one of the things I learned there helped me so much. I didn't think that there'd be anything that would help me, but there was something they taught us there, which was detach with love. Because it wasn't just the problem with my stepfather. My stepfather, I can understand, he was, you know, an angry drunk. He would belittle you. He would make fun of you. He would say nasty things to you. He would, you know, constantly, just a constant pressure beating you down. But my mother, having married him and then not defending him, was one of the things that it was very difficult to deal with.
And, Matt, detachment love, how would you describe what that is briefly?
Well, obviously, I have to deal with my mother still on a regular basis. I don't allow myself to get involved in the situation of my sister, for example, who she was 3 years old when my father died. And she's a brilliant girl. She has her PhD from the University of Chicago. But there's always been constant drama in her life. Always constant drama, and so much of this was the result of the abuse that she suffered as a child. And with her, I use the same theory. With all the things that happened in her life, with all the drama, with the drama that happens with my mother, I don't allow myself to get involved.
All right. Thank you, Matt. I appreciate that. I just want to make sure we give Emily a chance. I'm sorry for everything you've been through, and I thank you for sharing your story. And Matt has, you know, has worked a long time on this, and something he said, Emily, that worked for him was detachment love. Is that something you're familiar with that other people have talked about?
Not that phrase, but this idea of detachment, of you really have to make your own space, put limits, not get pulled back into the drama. That is so important. And I, you know, one thing that I've heard from many people is that they now had a spouse or friends or coworkers who would say, oh, you've got to get, you know, have closure with your mother or father. You'll feel so terrible if they die and you haven't healed everything. And I would say to people who have a friend or loved one who's dealt with the kind of childhood that Matt is describing, be very careful about pushing them into some kind of reconciliation, because boundaries and limits are really important, and it's really important for the person who was abused not to be pulled back into that old emotional orbit.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Matt, and we wish you well. And we're going to go next to Belin in Green Bay. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, just listening to the commentary and totally understanding the situation. Growing up in a very abusive family, and as a 62-year-old woman, recognizing that sometimes you're never accepted. You can learn to love from a distance, and that's the way it is sometimes. It's very hurtful.
Well, and I hear that emotion in your voice. Thank you for sharing that with us and letting other people know that they're not alone, maybe in feeling some of the things that you're feeling today. And obviously, these are cuts that take a long time to heal if they heal, Emily. What about loving from a distance and honoring from a distance for parents
well,
and children?
This again, you are here. I mean, your caller is 62, and the emotion is so raw. And people, as I say, my message was to the people who wrote to me, to people like your callers, do what you need to do to protect yourself, to protect the life you've built, your emotional functioning. And that often does mean, as we've heard, the distance or limits doesn't necessarily mean no relationship whatsoever. But it can, you know, this is stuff that you work out over a lifetime.
Talking with Emily Yaffe now, former Dear Prudence Advice columnist, talking about the grown children of abusive parents and what happens over the holidays and some of the issues that that raises. And we had a listener who emailed, "The holidays are very awkward for me because I still get together with my dad's side of the family. However, my dad goes to these events as well, and when he does, I pretend that he doesn't exist. That side of the family isn't happy with me because they refuse to believe the things that happened between my dad and I, and it's hard because he doesn't acknowledge me as his child but has gone out of his way to make my adult life difficult." So that raises another question here. What if people in your family don't believe you, some of the things that you say happened?
Again, this is something I heard over and over. Sometimes an abuser will pick one person and just pour their venom into this person and treat everyone else all right. I mean, it's such a horrifying syndrome. I think for those people, I mean, this person who's writing, you know, examine what's best for you. If these gatherings are so painful and bring you back to feeling abused and not being believed, spend the holidays with friends. You don't have to do things that make you feel worse or worse about yourself.
Now, Emily, this whole conversation is about learning what other people have gone through, too. But you also write about, you've written about celebrities who've had abusive relationships with their parents. And sometimes it helps to think that guy is a rock star and he still had to deal with all this stuff. Can you tell us some of those stories?
Yes, as I was researching the piece I wrote for Slate, rock star indeed. Bruce Springsteen had a very difficult, painful relationship with his father. And Warren Buffett had just a grossly abusive mother. And for both, I mean, these are two icons in their fields, and yet, you know, when they've talked or written about this, it is very raw and it's, you know, still real. Bruce Springsteen, in an article, a profile in The New Yorker, you know, it said after he grew up, he would drive by the house, his old house, and just relive these horrible memories. Interestingly, when he became successful, he bought his parents a new house. And I don't know if that helped heal things, but he, in this New Yorker profile, you know, there was this poignant comment from him how he still wished it had all been able to be different. Warren Buffett, the great billionaire financier.
Right, some similar things there, and we're out of time, but okay. I appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you so much, and I wish everyone a joyful holiday.
Thank you so much. Emily Yaffe with us there, contributing editor for The Atlantic and former Dear Prudence advice columnist for nearly 10 years at Slate. So in case this holiday season you're maybe feeling bad about stuff that you messed up, people you hurt when you didn't mean to, maybe your latest Pinterest fail, here's something that might make you feel a little better.
Miss Universe 2015 is Colombia! I have to apologize. The first runner-up is Colombia. Miss Universe 2015 is Philippines. It was my mistake. It was on the card.
I'm pretty sure that's a first for the Miss Universe pageant. It happened last night when host Steve Harvey accidentally declared the wrong contestant had won the Miss Universe pageant. He said Miss Colombia had won, had to backpedal, saying it's actually Miss Philippines, and both of them standing right there. Michelle Good is our technical director. She's always here in the studio with us. Michelle, we both watched this. What part of this made you cringe the most?
Oh, my God, that poor girl. I think when they ripped the crown off of her head when she was standing in front of everybody, that was probably the most humiliating
part. It's hard. Everyone is, you know, armchair quarterbacking this today. What could have they done different? Do you think anything could have been done to save this and make this a little less painful for everybody?
He should have read the card. It was in huge print. How could he mess it up?
And then you feel bad for him as an announcer. It's your worst nightmare.
Never work again. That's all I can say.
Well, hopefully he's having a better day today, as are Miss Colombia and Miss Philippines. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time.